Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have the amendments to the Articles of Confederation. So what we've covered so far are the Articles of Association. Actually, we started off with the Tory Acts this year. Then we got into the Articles of Association and some details of, you know, the Revolutionary War, the transition. We got into, and believe me, it was really more the political side of all of this. And then we dived into the Articles of Association. And then we got into the committee, or I should say the Annapolis Convention, where the recommendation for the Constitutional Convention was submitted to Congress. We got into Congress's proclamation, let's go do this. And then we just went through the basically each state's enabling of the delegates, selecting and enabling them to go do what is necessary to save the Union. And so, therefore, we kind of have things marching forward. Now, going into this Constitutional Convention, there was clearly well-known problems with the Articles of Confederation, which is why they basically opened it up to a convention. And more importantly, having eight attempts, of amending the Constitution. As a matter of fact, when we look at the final eighth attempt, it was really this wholesale attempt. It was like this Hail Mary, you know, long bomb that was, you know, in the spirit of football at this point in time. But it was this real Hail Mary attempt by Continental Congress to obtain the necessary powers that they felt they really needed. So it was kind of like a shopping list, or maybe, you know, a Santa gift list. Hey, Santa, give us these things kind of thing. So anyway, so what I'm going to do now, because we don't have Paul with us today, but I know that he's probably going to regret not being a part of this, because we're going to dive into each of these amendments and when they were really created, because it is disingenuous to say we just jumped into a constitutional convention with a blank check. They knew how problematic the Articles of Confederation were. The Continental Congress was basically lipstick on a pig. It couldn't force the states to do anything. It had no coercive powers. Now, what you want to do, and what they ended up doing, was they ended up granting the federal government coercive powers over very specific things, which is why with the whiskey tax and what they were doing regarding resistance or the whiskey rebellion to that whiskey tax, they ended up arresting 24 men, charging them with treason, and two were convicted of treason. I'm not talking about, you know, well, they, you know, refused, you know, tax evasion or anything like that. Back in those days, if you were evading taxes, you were treasonous. And so, because at that point in time, the taxes that were being applied were all necessary. Now, even though Hamilton was a very nefarious man, the federal government actually did need to establish some excise taxes and so forth. And so what we want to do is kind of go through all of this for you. And so in the very first amendment that was submitted, now this was 3 September 1781. Before the Articles of Confederation had been finally ratified, they had already submitted an amendment. And I'm not going to read all of them, but I'm going to give you the tone of this one. And so this one was resolved that it be recommended to the several states as indispensably necessary that they vest a power in Congress to levy for the use of the United States a duty of 5% ad valorem at the time and place of importation upon all goods, wares, and merchandises of foreign growth, manufacturers, in other words, raw material, manufactured material, or anything that may be imported, and I'm just adding that anything, which may be imported into any of the said states from any foreign port, island, or plantation. Now, see, at this point, they didn't have the power to go create, you know, at every port and every entry port, you know, whether it be on land or whether it be via the sea. They didn't have rail back then or airports, but where there was a port of entry into a state, the Continental Congress didn't have the authority to create an inspections building and be able to make sure that there was a tax levied on those goods. They needed to be able to raise some type of money. And you actually see this in the U.S. Constitution, or I should say the Constitution for the United States, where they've granted them this power to be able to do this, which is why very specifically the few pieces of property that are enumerated in the Constitution are for, you know, the erection of forts, magazines, shipyards, you know, basically for defensive or strategic military purposes and for needful buildings. They would need a building in each port to be able to house, you know, the marshal or whoever is going to account for all of the goods coming in so that that tax can be levied on those goods, because they did have the constitutional power in the Constitution to actually wage taxation or basically place tariffs and or taxes on importation of goods. So anyway, as we go through this, and then they basically did this on May 1781, and the except arms, ammunition, clothing. So in other words, they were putting an exception on these types of articles imported that were on the account of the United States. In other words, if the United States was importing arms, ammunition, clothing, and other articles for their purposes, then these things would not bear that tax. And so, because why, you know, you don't tax yourself for those things. Also, a like duty of 5% on all prizes and prize goods condemned in the court of admiralty, any of these states as lawful prize, that the monies arising from the said duties be appropriated to the discharge of the principal and interest of the debts already contracted or which shall be contracted on the faith of the United States for supporting the present war. Now, in 1781, they were still fighting that war. And so when we look at the next amendment to the Constitution, this amendment was basically, now let me see here, this was 16 March 1781. And I believe this is right around the time, this is just right before or right around the same time that the Articles of Confederation were being ratified. And this is an amendment to give Congress, this is a good one, and I think we'll dive into this one as well, to give Congress coercive power over the states and their citizens. Now, just the ring of that doesn't sound good, right? And this is how it goes. Whereas it is stipulated and declared in the 13th article of the Confederation that every state shall abide by the determinations of the United States and Congress assembled on all questions which by this confederation are submitted to them, and that the articles of this confederation shall be inviolably observed by every state, close quote, by which article a general and implied power is vested in the United States and Congress assembled to enforce and carry into effect all of the articles of the said confederation against any of the states which shall refuse or neglect to abide by their determinations or shall otherwise violate any of the articles. So in other words, they're basically saying that we need to have power to actually enforce these things because you guys are ignoring it. You gave us this responsibility to do these things and you're not supporting us. It goes on and says, but no determinate and particular provision is made for that purpose. And whereas the want of such provisions may be made a pretext to call into question the legality of measures which may be necessary for preserving the authority of the Confederation and for doing justice to the states which shall duly fulfill their federal, they call it federal, but it's federal engagements, and it's more most consonant to the spirit of a free constitution that on the hand all exercise of power should be explicitly and precisely warranted. Now, I want to pause right here. This is interesting because they're basically spelling out that the consonant or this the spirit of a free constitution really hinges upon this ability to exercise power that is explicitly and precisely granted, or they call it warranted. And on the other hand, the penal consequences of a violation of duty should be clearly promulged and understood. And whereas it is further declared by the said 13th article of the Confederation that no addition shall be made to the articles thereof unless the same shall be agreed to in a Congress of the United States and be afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state. The United States and Congress assembled, having seriously and maturely deliberated on these considerations and being desirous as far as possible to cement and invigorate the federal union, actually it was a confederacy and it was really a general government, not a federation, that it may be both established on the most immutable basis and be the more effectual for securing the immediate object of it, do by hereby to and recommend to the legislatures of every state to confirm and authorize their delegates in Congress to subscribe the following clause as an additional article to the 13th article of the Confederation of Perpetual Union. It is understood and hereby declared that in case any one or more of the Confederated States shall refuse or neglect to abide by the determinations of the United States in Congress assembled or to observe all of the articles of Confederation as required in the 13th article, the said United States and Congress assembled are fully authorized to employ the force of the United States as well as by sea and by land to compel such state or states to fulfill their federal engagements and particularly to make distraint on any of the effects, vessels, merchandises, or such state or states or any of the citizens thereof wherever found and to prohibit and prevent their trade and intercourse, their communications, as well with any other United States and the citizens thereof, as with any foreign state, and as well by land as by sea, until full compensation or compliance be obtained with respect to all requisitions by the United States in Congress assembled in pursuance to the Articles of Confederation. Now, let's take a quick look historically. As the colonies were operating, each of them had their own network. And as a matter of fact, it really wasn't a controlled network. People would move and move from England or where have you, from Europe, and come into a colony with the intent. And this was very common. This had been done for thousands of years, where a person or a group of people would basically move or migrate into a new area of commerce and with a intent to be able to bring the goods and wares of the products being made by their family and associates in the former country. Now, Thomas Sowell in Black Rednecks, White Liberals, an awesome book, dives into middleman minorities. And he talks about how we easily vilify these people that move into these countries, into these nations, where they are offering, you know, discounts and direct access to being able to buy jewelry or whatever types of wares that are being manufactured somewhere else. And so he points out, I think the Jews, the Chinese are the two that really come to mind, that they're very successful in doing this. What they do is they come in and next thing you know, they're importing, you know, rugs or jewelry or, you know, China. You know, why do we call it China? And as a matter of fact, that's an interesting historical rat hole I could go down. But anyway, as we started looking at these colonies, there was really an open net in every state or in every colony where people were coming in and seizing the opportunity of being bringing in refined goods, because it took a while for America to start manufacturing and start being able to bring in these processes that had been done for a long time in these other nations. I mean, we were still a, you know, an agrarian society where we were just built growing food and so forth, and factories and that organized, I don't even call it organized labor, but it's somewhat organized labor in factories were being well established throughout Europe. And even into the Mediterranean area where they'd been doing it even longer. So as, you know, as society grows and processes start spreading out, and improved processes are forming. And as a matter of fact, Adam Smith talks about this in The Wealth of Nations, how this is just the natural progress of a society. And so we had a lot of channels of distribution that were very independent. And that's the whole point I'm bringing up, that all of these states had their own independent channels of distribution, bringing in different types of wares that really weren't even controlled underneath the state or the colony's legislatures. They were taxing them, but these were all being done independently. These connections and the importation, this was all being done in a free market, so to speak. Now, to be clear, the free market was, you know, supporting those people, but there wasn't a lot of money here in America, so you could only bring in a little bit. But bottom line, as things started growing and as wealth started developing, these channels of distribution actually started growing. And so as we look at the Articles of Confederation, now we formed this union that was going to be able to impose taxation on all these goods coming in. At least that's what they were proposing. That's what they had formed this to do. That's how they were going to make their money. And so as soon as they formed and the Continental Congress started, you know, laying out these taxations and so forth and trying to actually cease all trade deals because they had the responsibility over trade, that only they could create these treaties. And so the problem was that they had to wipe out all of these existing trade agreements and these private lines or channels of distribution and move them underneath the Continental Congress regulations. So it was, you know, and as long as people could continue to smuggle or, you know, work directly outside of that, that's what we call a black market, right? A black market is a market that has zero regulation or visibility by the government. So in other words, the free market is what we call a black market, because the free market is zero regulations. It just operates on its own and people make transactions. And bottom line, those transactions are done by people on both sides that are willing. There's no compulsion. In other words, I agree to give you this money and you agree to give me that merchandise. And therefore, the transaction occurs and both parties are happy because they got what they paid for. They got what they, you know, of the expectation of the transaction. And so government has always, and Adam Smith talks about this, government always wants to get involved in every transaction, or at least at a high level of the transaction of these things coming in with a little, let's call it a piece of the action, a tribute to the government. Well, standing up the Articles of Confederation, and because they didn't have any power to enforce these things, this is why they were asking for this amendment. And so when we look at, you know, the growing pains of the of this republic and the fact that the states resisted, they didn't want to actually give these powers. Well, at least it was pretty apparent that they didn't have these powers. So why is this so important? Because going into the Constitutional Convention, all of these things were weighing on these people that were delegates who actually had experience in serving in Continental Congress. They understood the problems and the lack of support that they were getting, which is why they were able to create a constitution that was so well defined, and it really did limit. As a matter of fact, when we look at some of the things that they were asking for, that Continental Congress was asking for, because we're going to get into one of these coming up, in creating the ability to create commerce, or actually, well, we'll get into it. You're going to find that even these things were constrained and not allowed to the federal government. Why? Because the federal government was not to be a rich, wealthy body. It was a general service to protect the sovereignty of the Union and the sovereignty of the states, and that's all. It wasn't to have this, you know, this huge coffer, this huge treasure trove of resources and wealth. As a matter of fact, it was very clear in the ratification debates that when the kings and kingdoms and this rich opulence that was done by these empires, they controlled all of the land. And what we created was an inability for the federal government to possess any land other than what was necessary, which is why it was enumerated. They felt that these enumerations were necessary for the federal government. I mean, if we look at Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, as a matter of fact, this is kind of like the very last part of it. Actually, 16. 17 is the necessary and proper. 16 basically provides the federal government this very specific pieces of land and or property. And this is what it says: to exercise exclusive legislation in all things whatsoever. So we already know about the exclusive legislation over such district. And then they put in parentheses, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States. So in other words, they have this exclusive legislation, and then this is the exclusive legislation that is specifically over this district where the seat of the government of the United States is to occupy. This is their place to be unencumbered by any state government. In other words, this little parcel of land does not fall within a state so that the state can harass them. They are unencumbered completely. And so why, if you look at Washington, D.C., and the reason they put it where they did is because it straddled the Potomac. Now, when you look at the Potomac in those days, the Potomac was a sea-going river. As a matter of fact, the British floated. They brought a little flotilla up the Potomac, and they basically lay waste to Washington, D.C. in the War of 1812 when they attacked it. So it was really a sea-going river for those types of boats back in those days. Now, they also enumerated in subsection 16 additional property and or land. And it said basically, so they had the ability to regulate and possess. Well, we've got a break here. So when we come back, I'll dive into the only other land and or property that they could actually possess and why. They even identify, you know, the fundamental purposes of this land for these things. And so when we come back, we'll dive into this because this is so important. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as we were going into break, I was just telling you that there was this lockdown, an enumeration of properties or the types of properties or the constitutional application, or stated differently, let me see if I can come up with as many ways to say this as possible. The federal government can only possess properties for these specific purposes. And so this is what it says. And to exercise like authority over such places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the... In other words, these are the things that they shall be able to do. They just can't buy land from a state. And this is what it really says, purchased by the consent. Okay, so folks, when we look at states coming into the union and the federal government withholds land, now, did they purchase that land? No, they withheld it. The Constitution says they can't buy, they can't possess any land from a state unless it's been purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state. So they can't walk in and say, we're going to admit you, but we're not giving you all your land. Do you understand what thugs they became as they started admitting new states into the union? They literally and quietly, subversively moved themselves from being the subservient general government to the bully boss of the union by withholding resources and by literally, you know, they call the Department of Home or the Department of Interior the Department of Everything. Or actually, let me get into it because I actually have it in this petition that I'm doing for the Department of the Interior. Is this it? Is this the Department of the Interior? No, that's Commerce. So if that's 12, the petition 13 is the Department of the Interior. And let me see here. Where is it? The Department of Everything. I'm pretty sure we got it right up here. Yep, the Department of Everything Else. This is what the Senate was calling the Department of Home or the Department of Interior, because it seemed like they were getting all of these, you know, things, none of them being constitutional. In other words, as they started going crazy in assuming the ability to regulate fish and game and the ability to regulate trees, insects, minerals, I mean, there was, folks, this is actually, it's not funny. This is how crazy their tyranny had become. Now, today we just look at, oh, the mineral rights. Oh, all of these things that the federal government is controlling and possessing. Right? Oh, yeah, of course they have that. No, they don't. Those powers are not enumerated. When you hear me say more than 80% of our budget is going to regulating, consuming, possessing, and operating all sorts of things that are not enumerated. In other words, that's the magnitude of money we're spending on tyranny and allowing them to do things. Folks, this is like your landscaper. I love this analogy. Imagine, you know, you have a home and you finally decided you're going to, you know, make your property beautiful, and you want to have the most beautiful property in all of the community, not just your neighborhood, but not just the town. I mean, the county, the state, the sky's the limit. You want to be known as having the most beautiful property ever. And so you go out and you hire, or maybe you talk somebody into becoming, because of their skills or what have you, they're really good at landscaping and engineering, you know, civil engineering, those types of things, and say, you know what, I have a lot of property over here, and I want you to make my property the most beautiful property in the United States, if not the world. And you give them a contract that says, you know, do whatever it takes. And, you know, here's an open check to do this. You know, in other words, you have access to my funds to go do this. Now, nobody would ever do that, right? But let's just say you say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to go away. I'm hiring you as a landscaper, and, you know, I'll be gone for 2 weeks, and you do whatever you think is necessary to make this house as nice as you need. And you give them the keys to, you know, the access to the gate, the, you know, keys to the house and so forth, so that, you know, they can function as if, you know, so that way they don't have to go use the restroom or the facility somewhere else. You know, by all means, I'll be gone for 2 weeks. You know, make yourself at home. You come back after 2 weeks and you find out that the landscaper has put all of your, you know, possessions, your furniture, everything out in the back on this big, you know, patio that they've created, you know, this big, huge, you know, concrete, and it's a nice patio, but they put all that stuff there so that they could put and store all of their, you know, tractors and all of their hardware inside your home, so that they wouldn't have to, you know, ship it in and out. You know, just having all of the resources available to them just seemed like the easiest and the best way to go, so they could do this great job for you. That's okay, right? You told them to do whatever they thought necessary. That is why the Constitution doesn't say that. That's why when we read the Necessary and Proper Clause, and so... which is the very last part of the powers. This is the final subsection of the enumerated powers. And this is what it says: to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. Not to do whatever they think they want to do. Not to, oh, well, we think that this is best for us to do this. They don't have that authority. They only have the ability to make laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution these powers that are listed in Article 1, Section 8. So as we look at what these properties are, this is for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, and dockyards, and other needful buildings. Do you see anywhere here where they talk about trees? Do you see anything here regarding wild fish, game, anything like that? Do you see an opportunity where they could assume the land within your state before they create your state, before they allow your state? They just basically say, well, all this is federal land, and we're giving you this state, but this is ours. You can't have this. Not that we're going to erect a fort there, not that we're, you know, getting to put a magazine or an arsenal or a dockyard or even a needful building. These are resources that we want to commercialize. We want to be able to have an industry where we can make money and sell this stuff. folks. They were prohibited in this Constitution from being able to do that. How and why? Because it was not enumerated for them to do that. Again, this goes down the old citation in the ratification debates, as Mr. Nicholas so aptly put it, that when we see the federal government doing anything, and as a matter of fact, when we think it is in question, he makes the example as a comparison to England and the powers of the king versus the powers of the federal government and how to question them. In England, this is what George Nicholas says. In England, in all disputes between the king and the people, recurrence is had to the enumerated rights of the people to determine, are the rights in dispute secured? In other words, the king cannot step across these lines where there are enumerated rights of the people, which are included in the Magna Carta and the Glorious Bill of Rights. If not, they are generally speaking within the king's prerogative. Now, conversely, he goes on, in disputes between Congress and the people, the reverse of the proposition holds. Is the disputed right enumerated? Do they have the right to possess land in your state for any purpose that they want? No. If not, then they cannot meddle with it. There's nothing more plain and simple and spelled out. You know, I really loved Madison. Madison was just this brilliant man, but I'll tell you what. George Nicholas had articulated some points that were so clear. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm going to dive into this too, because one of the things that, you know, we start scratching our heads on as we kind of look at the Constitution, and, you know, most people don't even recognize that there's this constraint on the federal government from being able to create preferences. In other words, if the federal government comes along and says, you know what, we're looking to create an air, you know, a port, that you know, a Navy port or what have you, and we want all, you know, all these West Coast states to, you know, give us a bid of, you know, what we would submit, because this is what we're looking to do. And in other words, you know, bribe us, you know, what are you going to do for us to put that port or that base there? Now, to be clear, you know, they have the strategic interest, right? And so where should the ideas of state, you know, the erection of state shipyards or ports, naval ports, or any of these strategic military posts need to be? Now, let me ask you this. Now that we pretty much have a secure interior, other than the fact that we have ICBMs throughout the continental United States, why do we need so many military training bases throughout the United States? Why does the Department of Defense have so many bombing ranges and different, you know, artillery ranges and so forth? Oh, well, because they, you know, wanted to make sure that they gave everybody a little bit of kickback, you know, so that, you know, as many states that they possibly could, or actually, those were like pork barrel projects. Now, it says that they have this constitutional right to create forts, magazines, and so forth. My point is this, is that I honestly think that there should be a consolidation, a reduction, and as a matter of fact, there may be a secession, but bottom line, the Constitution says that the land must be purchased by the federal government with the secession of that land for this very specific enumerated process. They do not have the authority to possess land for, you know, agriculture, for people. Indian reservations, they don't have the right to do that. What should have happened is those Native Americans, the Indians, as they were sitting where they were, as states were forming around them, that that land became a part of the state and that the state needed to, you know, manage that. They made this real mistake in considering each of the tribes sovereign nations, because they're not a sovereign nation. It's almost like considering a religious faith, because, I mean, these are really more theocracies, aren't they? They're not necessarily governments, but they are just like what we see in doctrines and cultures, where they vary somewhat between one and the other, like Christianity. And I don't see, I mean, they had a way of life and so forth, but the framers were really clear. It was about assimilating and making, and as a matter of fact, the Cherokee were doing so good. They were so successful at becoming enterprising people that they became a threat to the people of the South, where they basically demanded that Andrew Jackson, you know, get rid of these people because they couldn't compete with them. They realized that these people were beating them at their own game. Now, this goes back to Thomas Sowell's Black Rednecks and White Liberals, when he talks about, you know, the attitude, the paradigm, the culture of the South at that point in time, and why was it that they were constantly being outdone? You know, as a matter of fact, Thomas Sowell paints this really, you know, I'll say a very distinct picture, that when you're floating down, I believe it was the Ohio River, when you looked to the land of Pennsylvania and you looked to one side of the river, you would see pasture lands where the trees would be cleared and stumps would be removed, where you could see some agricultural, you know, growing of crops and pastures for cattle and so forth. And on the other side of that river, you would see woods where, you know, you'd see cattle, you know, scattered in the woods or what have you, little crops here and there. In other words, they didn't take the effort, because it's a lot of effort to go clear trees and to pull up the stumps and to make that land as productive as possible. In other words, the minimalist approach of the South versus the, you know, the full, you know, needed effort of those people on the other side of that river. And it was a very stark contrast. One of the things that I think gets pointed out in that book was just the production of butter. Even though the South had more cows, the North was outproducing in butter because their cows were healthier, because their cows were better fed and better maintained. And so, you know, there's a lot of little things and nuances that we learn through all of this, I'll just say, this general historical reporting that really helps us understand, you know, why things were going the way they were. And so the federal government took advantage. Oh, you know what? You guys need some stuff, right? So we'll give you some money, but you got to do this for us. They started taking advantage and using the treasury to basically manipulate the states to basically fall in line to doing what they wanted done. So I was going to get into this preferential treatment and so forth. To be clear, the federal government, based on the uniformity clause of Article 1, Section 8, they had to be uniform. They had to treat each state the same. They couldn't give advantages or couldn't create burdens greater on one state and not on the other. So in other words, they didn't have the ability to do what they were doing by holding land away from these states and keeping these states from flourishing. Some of the things we read, like when we read this concept of federal lands and grasslands, where, you know, these ranchers were able, like the Bundys, were able to use federal lands for grazing. I'm here to tell you that federal land should not be federal land. That should be state land. And whether the state wants grazing or not, that's up to the state. The fact that the federal government did that was just another way of manipulating and creating a problem. Because that's exactly what happened. Now, in the ratification debates, there was constantly this talk about the Mississippi, you know, especially in the Virginia ratification debates. Why? Because Kentucky, which was the western lands of Virginia, went all the way over to the Mississippi. And so they had interest in maintaining the navigation of the Mississippi, because when we look at the Treaty of Paris of, what is it, 1783, the Treaty of Paris, the King of England recognizes the United States and basically issues that he recognizes that these colonies and the land between the Atlantic over to the Mississippi River is the United States. In other words, all that territory was basically under, you know, the cognizance of this Continental Congress and the United States, that there were these territories. Now, even though they did that, didn't mean that they weren't in those areas trying to manipulate Indians, creating agreements and trades and so forth, and getting the Indians to basically rise up against us. I mean, there was all sorts of manipulation by, you know, those civil people over there on that rock called the UK. But anyway, the discussion of preferential treatment as identified in the Constitution, because right here in Article 1, Section 9, these are restrictions placed on the federal government. Article 1, Section 9, right? And it says, no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels be bound to or from one state or obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another. In other words, they couldn't create preferences in one way or another. And it was actually expounded upon in the Virginia ratifications by George Nicholas, and this is what he said. There are many strong reasons to expect that the adoption of this system, this new constitution, this new government, will be beneficial to the back country, Kentucky, and that their interest will be much better attended to under new than under the old government. Now, just imagine this, looking at the Mississippi and the ability to basically bring ships and commerce from Kentucky out to the world, because that's what the Mississippi did, as well as bring commerce into them. It's almost like having the Atlantic Ocean, you know, getting a ship to actually go to Kentucky via the Mississippi was a lot easier, or getting that commerce there would be a lot easier than dropping it off in Norfolk, Virginia, and then dragging it across all of this terrain via wagon. They didn't have good roads in these days. And so it would be cheaper and less effort to actually keep it on a ship and put it on a barge and actually, you know, take it up the Mississippi. Anyway, under the old government, there are checks in this Constitution which will render the navigation of the Mississippi safer than it was under the Confederation. There is a clause which, in my opinion, will prohibit the general government from relinquishing that navigation. The fifth clause of the ninth section, which is what I just read to you, of the first article, which no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. If Congress be expressly prohibited to give preference to the ports of one state over those of another, there is a strong implication that they cannot give preference to the ports of any foreign nation over those of a state. This will render it unconstitutional to give Spain a preference to the Western country in the navigation of that river. They may say that it is constrained construction, but it appears to me rational that it would be a violation of the true policy to give such a preference. It would be a departure from the natural construction to suppose that an advantage withheld from the states should be given a foreign nation. Now, is this one clause? Is this an island? Is this one clause all by itself? No. When we go to Article 1, Section 8, will actually find the uniformity clause, you know, throughout. You'll actually find that they shall have they shall establish a uniform rule of naturalization. In other words, they can't create preferences for one nation over another for coming here and becoming citizens. Even though they did it, they had no authority to do that. And even though they're doing it today, the interesting thing is, in the early days of the United States, they maintained, the majority of the people that were coming here were from Europe. And they actually prohibited, and most all of the states actually prohibited anybody from coming here and openly practicing any religion other than Christianity. All of the states actually had bans on Jews, and most Muslims were banned until the 1900s. So it's not that that wasn't, you know, happening, but the fact is we now have a situation where the federal government is actually bringing people and enticing people and allowing people to come across our southern border and violate the immigration laws and actually allow them to come in and to not be assimilated and to become potential hostile operatives in America. In other words, they're actually doing what Britain was doing in creating manipulations. In other words, are we just a puppet following the British, you know, monarchies and this British crown of allowing ourselves to be manipulated in actually creating destructive policies and allowing destructive things to be implemented here in America? It is hard for me to fathom, folks, why our government is choosing to actually wage warfare on our culture and on this nation. I cannot fathom the evil of a nation, or leaders of a nation, I should say, that actually seek to do such a thing. It is not within their powers. The Constitution stops us. And I'm here to tell you, folks, that the good Lord, our Creator, knew everything we would need because he knew what we would be facing in these days. These days are the days of the, whatever you want to call it, the dreadful days of the Lord, the great tribulation, whatever you want to call it, folks, these are those days that we're heading into. And the confusion is only going to get worse, but the Constitution is clear. They can't do these things. All we have to do is use petitions and demand compliance, full compliance of the Constitution, and start removing every public servant that chooses not to fully support this Constitution. We need militias down on that southern border stopping this invasion and repelling the invaders from America. We got 40 to 50 million. Tomorrow we're going to dive into some things that I usually very rarely dive into, and it's really more of the bio and the details of Republic Review and reclaiming the Republic and why we're doing all of this stuff. So welcome back, and we will be back tomorrow. Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.